everyone. Welcome back. Good of you to join us. I hope you're doing well wherever you are in the world. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Today we are talking with journalist and author Ingrid Karlqvist from Sweden, who joins us from Copenhagen in Denmark today. She's behind the website Dispatch International that she started together with Danish historian Lars Hedegaard. Our mission today is to continue our ongoing discussion that we've had about Sweden, that we proceed to examine from various angles where the country has been, where she is going, as a rapid change is underway in certain areas while at the same time being stuck deeply with both feet in a rigid political past. We will discuss Swedish history, the media environment, the myth of a free press in this internationally praised climate of tolerance and fairness. We'll also talk about the issues of mass immigration into Sweden, the future of belief, religion, and more politically incorrect topics that the media in Sweden refuse to touch. All right, well, welcome, Ingrid. It's a pleasure to have you with us here on Red Ice Radio. Thank you for coming on, first of all.
Thank you, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, this is going to be interesting. We've of course, focused on Sweden in a lot of our programs in the last couple of years here to give our international audience a little bit of an idea of what is going on within the country and everything else, and you have a particular interest in both background but also, you know, kind of perspective that we're going to get into here today. But first of all, why don't we just talk a little bit about your background and why you or you guys over there, rather, started your website, Dispatch International. Tell us about that.
Yeah, first of all, I've been a journalist in all my life, almost. I was just 18 years when I started the education to become a journalist. And, I mean, why did I do it? Well, because I love writing. And I was kind of an idealist, you know. I wanted to change the world, as so many young journalists want to. But it didn't take me many years to figure out that most of the journalists, they're not interested in, you know, telling the truth or so. It used to be better when I started, but now I would say that Swedish journalists are more into hiding the truth than telling the truth. We have a lot of areas that Swedish journalists, they don't cover it at all. And if they do, they actually don't tell the truth. They preach to people. They tell people what to think to be a real good moral person. If you see what I mean.
Right. They make moral, value judgments for you when you're meant to align yourself according to the opinions that they express in their paper. What happened then, Ingrid? How did this transformation occur, if you could see it, or how would you define it if you've seen that in your lifetime?
Well, it's hard. That is the question I struggle with each day. Why are they doing this, and when did it start? I think that Sweden has not always been like this, but since World War II, you know, we struggle with a lot of bad conscience about World War II because Sweden was neutral and we didn't do as much as we could have done to help Jews and so on. And most of Sweden was a bit pro-Nazi, at least up until 1942, when they realized that Hitler was going to lose the war, or probably
a lot of Europeans was up until that point. I think Italy was aligned with them. You know, there was a lot of sentiments within the British royal house, you know, with Hitler. But yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, but we have a special kind of white guilt in Sweden, and I'm not really sure why that is. But I think it has something to do with World War II and probably something in the genes. I don't know. But when did it start? When did Swedish journalists become so afraid of telling the truth? I think it's always been like this. Swedish journalists, they think of themselves as better than ordinary people. Journalists are, they believe that they can handle the truth. But, you know, the ordinary reader can't handle the truth. So journalists always talk about, they know perfectly well, you know, that the rape wave in Sweden is about immigrants. And they know that gypsies are the ones that commit all almost all the crimes against old people and so on. But they think that if they let ordinary people know these things, then Swedes will go out on the streets and start killing gypsies or Muslims or whatever. Why they think this is a mystery to me, because we Swedes are not known for being very violent or, you know, just killing people for being part of a certain group. But actually, that's what they think. Swedish journalists are very, they look down on ordinary people and their readers, and they see themselves as creatures. They have to, they can't tell the truth, but they must tell people something else, because if they, if people know the truth, they will become violent.
Ah, well, we'll get into some more details there in some of the points that you brought up, but what do you think, who has taken charge of this then? I mean, we had a recent guest with us. We talked somewhat about the, you know, where the journalist gets trained. There are a few journalists, you know, schools in Sweden, and that this is really where the indoctrination, we should say, maybe, of the journalists take place. Would you agree with that, or does this happen somewhere else, within the environment, perhaps, at some of the papers that they begin to work at, and the editors are clear in terms of what they can or can't write, or how does it work?
I think it starts in the school, because who are the teachers in the school? They are older journalists, and they tell them how to act as a journalist. And when you start working, when you come to your newspaper or your radio station, some of them are quite curious when they start working out as journalists, and they want to tell new things. You know, people just don't want to do the same story all over again. But when they, if they try to write perhaps about the rapes or something like that, they will find out, as many of us have done, that you can't write the truth. Because then the editor-in-chief will say that, no, this is not the kind of story that we want in our paper. So if they want to have a career, they must accept the rules. And some of them don't, and they stop being journalists, because they realize, why would I stay in this job that is not so very well paid? I mean, you have to be in the really big newspapers to have a good salary. Most of them have quite ordinary salaries. But if you want to keep that, you must do as they tell you. And that's why many people stop working as journalists. The really good ones, the one that we would really need, they don't want to work as journalists anymore.
Right, right. And so is this true all across the board, from the smaller local papers to the major government subsidized media outlets up there?
Oh yes, all over the board.
And how do they manage to keep this in such a lockstep? Because it's very organized, then, isn't it? Very organized.
Yeah, but it's not so difficult to understand, because every article is read by someone. You always have a boss that will read what you write, and if you don't have, if it's a really small paper and they just let you, you know, write whatever you want, the next day you can be sure that you will have your boss will tell you that this is no good, and if you do that one more time, things will happen, or, you know.
This is pretty sad for a lot of people to hear them, because on the international scene, it's, I think, a lot of people anyway have the perception that Sweden has been very prone to free press, and we have a rich history of that. In fact, we have some, I guess, heroes, if you will, in Sweden. I actually forget the name of him now, because we never get taught this in school, but that actually, way, way back, Sweden was one of the first countries to move towards a free press, and freedom of opinion, freedom of speech, etc. So that's a very sad step that we've taken, right?
Yes, it is. And, you know, Sweden is actually the first country that had a law saying that you could not censor the media in advance. And that's actually a person that I wrote about a few months ago, and his name was Peter Forsskål.
Right, that's right, yeah.
But the strange thing is, not even I had ever heard of him until I read an article in the daily Svenska Dagbladet. And he is really a hero of free speech and free press, but we don't know his name. Why don't we know his name? Because I think that, well, I don't know. We are very proud that we were first in the world, but we don't tell people what it was about. It's just like it's one of those things that Sweden can brag about, but you don't have to educate people of what really happened. But that's a real interesting story about this man, Peter Forsskål, and he wrote a small script, a small pamphlet, so to speak, and about civil rights, and he had to go with this pamphlet to different printers, and suddenly he found someone who agreed to print it, and the state actually confiscated. I think he printed like 500 copies or something like that, mm-hmm. and they confiscated 80 of them. The rest had already been delivered, but that's where it all started. And in this article that I read that made me write my article, it was a librarian at the Swedish Royal Library, or whatever it's called in English, and the librarian told a story about him having a group of members from the Swedish Parliament and he asked them, do you know why there were so many pamphlets written during the 16th century? And they all looked at him like they didn't have a clue. So, I mean, people, members of the Swedish Parliament, they don't know the first thing about Sweden's our status as the first country with a really free press.
Right, right. So, obviously, one could reason that because we've had this free press for the longest, it's also been under attack for the longest. And to me, then, it seems that we truly have lost it by this stage, but not by law then, but by gatekeepers keeping it outside of the press, the editors, censoring, etc. But what are some of the topics, would you say, that are not touched upon within, Swedish press, some of the important subjects that you try to highlight on your paper that you would basically get fired for, I guess, if you would talk about them in a bigger scale?
Yeah. First of all, it's all about immigration. I mean, you are not allowed in Sweden to say that I don't agree with the government's policies on immigration. Because if you say that you have a different opinion, I mean, not wanting 100,000 immigrants per year to Sweden, if you say that, you will be labeled a racist, a xenophobe, maybe even a Nazi, just for saying it. I mean, it's not about saying that I hate people from different countries. It's not at all about that. It's just saying I don't think that the government's policy is very good on this subject. Because if you do, you will be labeled a racist. And what happens if you are being labeled a racist? Well, you can lose your job, your career, your friends, your family, and you will be totally, a pariah in society. And that is why so many people have had this experience, and now people know what will happen if you voice your opinion. So very few people dare doing that now.
So what kind of climate do you think that this creates ultimately when we're not allowed to have an open discussion, a free debate about these things, but again, that you are basically shunned in the mainstream if you do voice a difference of opinion? I think that the polarization that already is occurring is going to get much stronger, but I think it's going to have worse consequences, don't you?
Well, this is a climate of fear. You must know that the Swedes, they are living in fear. It's like, I guess, it's like in the DDR, where people could barely talk to their own family members about certain things because you could never trust your spouse or your children because some of them could be a Stasi agent. And I think that's what we Swedes are living through right now. People are so scared of saying the wrong things to the wrong person that they just become quiet. Sweden is a country of silence. And that's why the alternative media have become so popular during the last 2 or 3 years, because you still can read them without a government telling you that it's forbidden. You can still comment anonymously. So there's, I think, on the internet, that's where you can really say what you want, but you can't. A few people do it with their real names. I mean, 99% of them are anonymous. But how long will we have this opportunity? I'm not sure, because especially the Swedish media, they are, you know, arranging campaigns to shut down alternative media,
yeah,
calling them hate media and hate sites. So I think maybe it's just a matter of time before they will, you know, pass some law saying that if you don't have the certain values, you are not allowed on the internet.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I remember very recently now, I think there was one new website, new paper, I guess. They're actually a paper version of their you know, articles out there as well. Free Times, Fria Tider, I believe, actually managed to get press subsidies. I actually don't know much about this paper. I haven't kept up too much about this particular one, so I don't know some of the you know, politics or whatever. But nonetheless, I know that there was an immense campaign to basically go after, you know, this guy, the editor-in-chief of this paper. What do you know about this situation?
Well, I'm very happy that they got their subsidiaries, really, and I hope that we will get it too. But, you know, the minister, the one in charge of, you know, press things, she has already said that she wants a new law forbidding certain papers to have this money, and she calls it the democracy paragraph or something like that. But it's not. It's got nothing with democracy to do. Actually, she just wants newspapers that don't agree with a Swedish policy on immigration to be banned from, you know, having this money. I don't know anything about the campaign against the editor in chief. But I know what I've been through, and my co editor,
right,
Lars Hedegaard.
Yeah.
You know that they tried to shoot him.
I did not know that. So maybe you can tell us about that story.
Yeah, Lars Hedegaard is the Danish editor in chief. I mean, this paper that we do is a Swedish Danish paper, and we publish everything in English too, because that's why we're called Dispatch International, because we think that Sweden and Denmark can't solve our problems by ourselves. We need people all over the world to see what's happening here, and it's sort of the same problems all over the Western world, but maybe Sweden is the country that is in most danger of becoming a totalitarian society. But we started the newspaper a year ago, and in February this year, a man came to Lars Hedegaard's door with he was dressed as a postman, as a mailman, and he said he had a package for Lars. And Lars went down to open the door, and the man pulled out a gun and shot at him, and I'm so happy that he missed, the bullet went right beside his ear, and Lars, who is a man of he's 70 years old, but he's a strong man, and he started to fight this guy.
Right.
So the gun went off two more times, but missed Lars all every time, and the guy who was a Muslim of I don't know where he was from, but he was not a Dane, and he looked like someone from Pakistan or something like that. And he got away, and the police never found him. So this is what you're up against if you talk about, if you have a critical opinion about immigration and Islamization. That's the reality we live in. But do you think anyone cares? The first thing that happened in Sweden when this news got out was that a lot of journalists started writing that how could they know that this really happened? Maybe Lars just made it up.
Ah, and yeah. In this case, it's a conspiracy. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, the police got the bullets and everything, so there was nothing pointing to it being made up. But the Swedish journalists, they just don't want these kind of stories. So they had to make Lars the bad guy.
Well, how about that? I mean, we know about the situation in, particularly with focus on Denmark, has been pretty intense in the last couple of years. Some of the stories published by, I believe, Jyllandsposten, for example, when we had riots around the world, Danish embassies, etc. And it's been a long struggle, and this has expanded into Sweden as well. And I know that at times certain artists and comedians have had to get police escort or security, help because it was a true danger towards their lives, right? Maybe you can clarify some of the names for us. They're not on the top of my head right now, but there are a couple of examples like this, right?
Yeah. First of all, it's the Danish cartoonist Kurt Vestergaard who made the famous picture of Muhammad with a bomb in his turban.
Right.
They tried to kill him several times, and he has protection round the clock. And in Sweden, we have Lars Vilks, the artist who made a cartoon of Muhammad as a dog. And you can't do that if you want to stay alive. Mm. And there were two guys trying to burn his house down, but they were so clumsy and so stupid that they only managed to set fire on themselves. So they threw away some of their clothes, and the police found their ID cards in the clothes. So it was not very difficult to find them. And they actually had to go to the hospital, too, because they caught fire themselves. But he, too, now lives with protection around the clock. And what do you make of this situation? I mean, the strange thing is that in Sweden, nobody cares very much about this artist, Lars Vilks. They tried to kill him. They've tried several times. But people say, why should he have this police protection? It costs a lot of money for the taxpayers.
Right.
But if a Muslim woman claims that she has been abused by men, we don't even know if they were Swedish men or not, but she claims that she was abused and someone tried to take her veil off, then the whole apparatus goes on with, politicians and celebrities, and they started this hijab, I don't know what it's called in English. They wanted to, show how all Muslim women must have their hijab. So a lot of Swedish politicians and celebrities put on a hijab for one day just to show solidarity.
Right, like a big media rally kind of thing. Yeah,
a media rally. And it's so strange. The real horrors, the people saying, it's my right to criticize whatever I want. We have freedom of speech in this country. We don't care about them. Sweden don't care about them, but if a Muslim woman says that someone tried to pull her veil off, which of course is not a good thing, but I mean, that's not nearly as horrible as someone trying to kill Lars Vilks, then the media is quiet.
Yeah, it's a tremendous double standard. Just as long as it's anti, you know, Swedish, it's all good, it's all fine. But so this is a real problem that for people who don't know about this current climate in Sweden, in Denmark, and then of course I can just bring this other example up, another gentleman whose fate wasn't as lucky as you know, the two Lars that we were talking about, in this case the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, right? His father, Johan van Gogh, they were from the van Gogh family, the artist, the painters. He was stabbed several times right in the middle of the street in Holland. When was this? 2003 or something? 2004 maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So that's kind of the environment in Europe right now. We've had a long tradition of you know, free press, of debating, of arguing, of saying what we want, etc. But in this particular question, the lid has just completely come on, and there's no decisions whatsoever being made on any in terms of any referendums of what is to happen with our country. So what is this all about, do you think? Why is this happening? Why is it that we can't be critical of mass immigration, Ingrid?
Yeah, and that's so strange because, I mean, that's the European way, isn't it, to criticize everything and to have our freedom of speech and, you know, ridiculing one another. That's the European way. It's been like that since the Enlightening times. But what's happened is a mixture of two things. One is fear. I mean, the Muslims have shown, not all Muslims, of course, but some Muslims have shown time and again that they will kill you if you say something bad about Islam or Muhammad. So a lot of people are really scared for their lives. I mean, should you do it when you risk being killed? And then you have, on top of that, you have all the politicians saying every time that a Muslim terrorist goes out killing someone, saying, this is not Islam. Islam is the religion of peace. These are people who have totally misunderstood Islam. And why are they saying that? I mean, the terrorists, the killers, they are just following the Quran. The Quran tells them that this is not only permitted, but it is your free ticket to paradise. So it's a mixture of these things. You are scared to death of saying what you think, and the politicians telling you that this is not the real Islam, which it is.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of debate about this back and forth, even voicing various translations, and I've been involved in this myself and trying to wiggle this out. What particular version have you read of the Quran? Because some say no, it's all good, it's all fine, it's not in there. While other people are adamant, they're just like, nope, it's really violent, and the expressions are in there. So which one have you read, Ingrid?
I mean, you can read that. It's all over the internet. You don't have to go out and buy yourself a copy of the Quran because it's almost unreadable. It's so, you know, it's so strange, and a lot of it doesn't make any sense. But on the internet, you can find all the verses, and you know there are so many people have written about this, and you can see for yourself that 90% of the Quran is ideology, and maybe 10% is sort of, you know, religious, nice stuff about God and so on. But it is an ideology, and it's a totalitarian ideology that wants to rule everything in your life. How to dress, how to go to the bathroom, which people you can work for, which people you can have as your friends. And don't forget that Muslims are only supposed to be friends with other Muslims. This is the most racist ideology that's ever been on this earth. And it's not rocket science. Just go on the web and search for it. Search for the Jew hatred in the Quran. It's full of it. You know, we just published a story today about the strange thing that everybody is saying, that Islam was radicalized by Nazism, that it was the Nazis who brought the Jew hatred into the Quran, and that's sadly stayed on. That's bullshit. It's not true. The Quran has been here for 1400 years or something, and you can go on the internet and just look it up for yourself. It's full of hatred against the Jews.
So Sweden has left a lot on its previous, I should say, religion. We've of course gone through many transformations and many different beliefs and faiths, but to a large extent it's very much atheist, I would say, Sweden. And at the same time, I've also noticed that there is also, there is a void of belief. There's a void of something deeper. And you know, personally, from my point of view, this necessarily doesn't have to be fulfilled by a religion, but nonetheless, it's been a functioning and working way for a lot of people to kind of adopt some of the deeper questions. So therefore, I guess my question would be, do you think it's possible that when we have another strong religion coming in, like Islam is now in Sweden, is there any risk that Sweden more and more, I mean, talking about even Swedes now, native Swedes, national born, also beginning to adopt Islam because it might be another religion that can fill that void that has been there for quite some time? I mean, we've seen this in small scales and small extents, but do you think it's possible that they might spread to the larger population, Ingrid?
Yes, I do, Eric, and I think you're onto something very important here. First of all, I don't know if you've heard about the book called The New Totalitarians.
Yeah, I recognize that. But help to clarify that for us who don't know.
It's a book written by an American who used to be a foreign correspondent in Stockholm during the 1970s, I think. I forgot his name right now.
Roland Huntford.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And he wrote this book about, he thought that Sweden was a totalitarian country, and he called us the New Totalitarians. And in one of the first chapters, he describes how very easy the Reformation was in Sweden.
Yes.
In most countries, there was a struggle between the Catholics and the Protestants for hundreds of years. But in Sweden, it was like almost overnight. People just changed.
Isn't that interesting? That's very interesting.
It's very interesting because it gives you the creeps thinking about maybe Sweden will just, you know, become an Islamic country just overnight. And because I think it's sort of in our genes to follow what the authorities tell us. That's the one thing. The other thing is that you're absolutely right that most Swedes are atheists, but most of them are still members of the Church of Sweden, mm-hmm. and they go to church to baptize their children and to bury people, and at Christmas, you know, for singing carols and so on. So I think that the church still has a place in the heart of most Swedes, but it's become you're ridiculed if you say you are a Christian. If you are a Christian in Sweden, that means you are not thinking, you are not a intellectual person, because intellectual persons must be atheists. That's one of the problems in Sweden, that we have decided that you can't believe in God at the same time as being a person of science, for example.
Right.
Yeah, and so what's happened? The Church of Sweden, they are very sad that so few people come to Mass. So they now look at the Muslim societies and the Muslims, the mosques, and they are seeing that those people are very religious, and they come to Mass, and they come to pray Friday prayers and so on. So a lot of Swedish priests, they are envious of the mosques, and they think that if they cooperate with the Muslims, they will make Swedes more into the Church of Sweden and Christianity. But of course, this is crazy, and what's happening is that they want the religious feeling in Islam, so they invite imams to the church and think that, that they will create sort of a common feeling for God, because they say that we have the same God. I beg to differ. I think there is no resemblance at all between the Christian loving God and the hateful Allah of Islam. But that's another thing. But what has happened to... I don't know if you know that, but the Church of Sweden was very pro-Nazi during the Second World War, ever since the 1930s. We also published an article about that the other day. And I think the same thing is happening once again. The Church of Sweden looks at a totalitarian ideology and say, wow, this is so good. Look at all those people coming to the prayers. Maybe we can learn something from this. And it's actually the same God, so what's the difference? What they don't understand is that if you invite an imam and Muslims to a church, they will consider this church as a mosque. They will consider it as theirs. Not now, but in a few years' time, if the Church of Sweden goes on like this, it will be not a Christian church anymore, but a Muslim mosque. And I don't know if you follow this, but the other day, they chose the new archbishop in the Church of Sweden, and it's a woman. Her name is Antje Jackelén. She's from Germany, but a Swedish citizen since many years. And do you know what her motto is?
No.
Every Swedish bishop has a motto.
Right.
And her motto is, God is greater. And what is that in Arabic? Allahu Akbar. I don't think that is a coincidence.
It's funny how they play with these symbolic things all the time, back and forth, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've had...
And another thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just remembered, she had the question a few weeks ago. She was asked if Jesus gives a better description of God than Muhammad does. And she couldn't answer that question. She said, well, on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's the same God. Muhammad is as good as Jesus. Something like that. And that is the new Archbishop of the Church of Sweden.
Well, that seems to have been the case. It's very, it's kind of very frail in its stance towards anything, really. And that's really also very much the Swedish way, in the middle of the way, right? Lagom, we have these terms that don't even exist in some other, you know, languages. And so is it just that they are trying to cater to everybody? Is it just that they are in that politically correct zone, you know? Or is there something else going on here, Ingrid? Is there a deeper agenda that is really involved in breaking down the old religion and consequently kind of paving the way for new? Do you really think that's going on, you know, by people who are consciously planning this?
Well, I don't know. I ask myself this question every day. Why is all this happening? Why is the Church of Sweden going going to a more Muslim way of thinking? And why are the politicians destroying our country? Why do they do it? I don't think there's a great conspiracy behind it. I think it's more that, you know, one thing leads to another. And since the politicians, the elites of this country has decided that you cannot criticize certain things, then you start talking and, no, you stop talking and you stop thinking, and then one thing leads to another. And then they can't go out and say, oh, sorry, we got it wrong. So now they have to, you know, just follow the path that they started on. And I think it's going to end with a total crash. I mean, I think that Sweden as a welfare state will cease to exist in a few years. But I believe the politicians, they'd rather do that than saying we were wrong.
And some seems to have kind of alluded to this, so on the political scene in Europe, at least, when it was kind of declared by some of the major European politicians that multiculturalism had failed. We had this, you know, Merkel mentioned it, then we had Sarkozy, and then shortly after was the British Prime Minister, whoever that was at the time. So they, and what I found interesting, I brought this example up before with a lot of people, but I find it interesting because to me it shows that they're making the public statement to kind of plant the seed in people's head that, okay, it's, you know, it was an experiment and basically it has failed because it's gone out of control kind of thing. But then they've left it there. There haven't been any consequent discussion really about, all right, so what do we do about it now? How do we approach this? What do we, you know, obviously none of this kind of situation has been going on in Sweden, but at least in Europe, it's been out there a little bit. So what do you make of those comments, and what do you think could be done about this then? If this is a problem, if there's no, you know, debate about this, there's no referendums, people are not allowed to vote for, you know, are we pro mass immigration, are we not, you know, how do we deal with it, you know? So what's going to happen here, Ingrid?
Well, that's a difficult question. First, about why did they say that multiculturalism has gone wrong? I'm not really sure why they said it, because as you say, it didn't lead up to anything. They just said it like, okay, and then let's talk about something else.
Right.
I think that maybe it's like this. We see in all European countries now new parties becoming very popular, the parties that go against these immigration policies and against the EU. And maybe it's a way of saying, okay, we know that we made some mistakes, but on the whole, there is not so many problems. I think that's why they said it, because they want these new parties not becoming so popular as they are. But I think they will not succeed in this, because more and more people are beginning to realize what's happening in Europe, and that we are going to lose our freedoms if we don't change the course within a few years. So what can they do? They try to, you know, say that these new parties, they are racist and they are this and that. And maybe people don't dare to speak their mind, but once in a while you can go to the elections and give your vote. And I think that we will see a lot of new parties becoming very popular. I think the first thing we will see is in the vote for the EU Parliament coming May. I think we will see a lot of what they call populist parties becoming really big.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be not so nice for the you know, the old parties. And then we have an upcoming election in Sweden too in a year.
Right. And there's of course been a rise of the Swedish Democrats within Sweden in the last few years, and I found it very interesting though that, and this has happened in a number of other cases, that despite this being a democratic process and despite people, you know, voting as they so please, you've seen very much the same treatment, if you will, on within the media environment, as you described earlier in this program, that it's been a, like there's a unanimous, you know, opposition to them, that like this is we're so ashamed, all of us internationally, like we don't know what's going on or who's voting on these parties, but it's like there's no understanding whatsoever there, which is kind of funny to me in the way that they've been gatekeeping the dialogue, keeping it out. Don't they understand reverse psychology, that the more you try to, you know, prevent something from happening, the more you try to, you know, oppose it, kind of the stronger that opposition will grow. It's almost like, I mean, to me, if we look at that kind of mentality within Europe, it's almost like that the long-term strategy here is to harden and radicalize Europe and polarizing it even more by simply denying, you know, dialogue and discussion to go on about it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know if they really understand what they are doing, because you can't say that we love democracy and then tell people that if you voted for this party, like the Swedish Prime Minister did, Fredrik Reinfeldt, he told, after the last election in 2010, he told a group of students in Stockholm, the Stockholm University, he said that the reason that he started to cooperate with the Green Party, who is really fanatic about immigration, they want to, you know, take millions of asylum seekers into Sweden. The reason that he started to cooperate with them was to tell all the Swedes that had been naughty enough to vote for the Sweden Democrats that if you vote for the Sweden Democrats, I will give you more of all the things that you don't want. And it's, I mean, that is not democracy. I mean, they got like 5% of the votes or something like that, and now they're up on 10 or 12%, and I think that maybe you will see that they get 15% in next year's election. But the strange thing is that how can you say that you are a Democrat and then telling people that if you don't vote for the parties that I think is good parties, then I will do everything in my power to use undemocratic methods to make sure that all you people that want this, you will have nothing to say about.
Well, I mean, that's a classic example right there. It's you know, tolerance within those limits, right? It's just as long as you know still do what I say, you know, kind of thing, then it's fine. But if you step outside of those boundaries, even with the infrastructure of you know, democracy that we've given you, then it's wrong, and we're gonna, you know, oppose that. So I find it very interesting to watch that. And so, you know, Ingrid, we're gonna take a break here in a little bit, but what would you say to those who basically think then that these are, you know, these parties that we see on the rise within Europe, they're just, you know, right wing nutters, they're haters and racists and everything else, and those who might be not understand at all, let's say, of why this, again, this, I go back to that point, this polarization to happen, that when you're denied to within these countries in Europe to discuss about these things, when the discussion doesn't take place really within the media, etc., you have this, you know, polarization, you have a stronger opposition happening, and therefore I say then ultimately that I blame those gatekeepers for that polarization, that, you know, radicalization, if you will, is absolutely understandable. But what would you say to those people who just think that these are, you know, nutcases and don't know what's going on?
I think it's really a sad thing to say. I mean, they used to say here in Sweden that the only ones that voted for the Sweden Democrats were uneducated, young, white, angry men. Okay, maybe that's true, but why do they vote for the Sweden Democrats? Because they are the first ones that are being, you know, they're seeing the downside of the immigration. The violence, the rapes, the muggings, the robberies, the abuses is taking place in the areas where they live. Of course, the people who, the media elite, the journalists, the politicians, they don't live in those areas. They think that immigration is such a nice little thing that enriches our country. But the people who really live with it, they see the consequences. Of course, they are the first ones that are going to vote for these parties saying, stop it, We have our own citizens. We must help them first. We can't just bring along people from all over the world trying to save them and giving them our money that the taxpayers pay for securing, healthcare and pensions and everything. They are not racist. They are not Nazis. They are not xenophobic. They are just ordinary people trying to get on with their lives, and they are seeing that is actually becoming impossible in Sweden and all over Europe.
I have much more I want to ask you about regarding this, of course, Ingrid, a lot more in terms of the statistics, the political correctness. I want to, tie this into the bigger, questions in terms of, how you view, Sweden as well, and how you see what's going to happen here in the future. Internationally, we're very much, promoted to be as one of the, happiest and safest places in the world. And yet, so what you've been mentioning so far is obviously contradicting that. So we're going to get into those things as well. But why don't we end this first segment here with you giving us some details about your website, Ingrid, and Lars' website as well, so that people know where to go if they want to, read more articles from you guys and keep up to speed with what you're doing.
Yeah, they go to Dispatch International, and the website is d-intl.com.
D-intl for Dispatch International. We're going to have that linked up there as well. All right, well, thanks, Ingrid. Stay with us here. We're going to continue in a little bit. We'll be right back with more. Right, everybody, thank you for joining us thus far. We will continue with a second hour with Ingrid Carlqvist. We're going to talk more about the increase of sex crimes and rape in Sweden. On the flip side, state feminism is devouring Sweden from within, and you have ridiculous things like the rape charges against someone like Julian Assange. We'll get Ingrid's take on those developments. Later, we'll talk more about the political climate in Sweden, the lack of choice, normalcy bias, and the concept that Sweden has been a political laboratory. And this, to the rest of the world, brand new soft totalitarian state, is currently Sweden's biggest export. All right, you can tune in at redicemembers.com, subscribe and listen to our continuation and all our previous programs right there. We have a lot of material from a lot of different angles that I bet will exercise your mental and philosophical abilities, and at the same time push the limits of your belief. Thank you for listening. We'll speak to you on the other side of the break.